This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The Money. I'm Richard Aidy. How do we know that more education tends to mean more income, or that you can raise the minimum wage a bit without losing jobs? We know because of the work of three researchers who shared the most recent Nobel Prize for Economics. Between them, David Card, Joshua Angrist and Guido Imbens were able to find causal relationships in seemingly fuzzy data. Richard Holden, who's at the UNSW Business School, says this brought about what's now called the empirical revolution.
That's all about finding ways to use observational data, data that happens in the real world, to understand the causal effect of some policy on something we care about. So if we raise the minimum wage, how much, if at all, does that increase unemployment? If we give longer prison sentences, how much does that, if at all, reduce crime? Things like that. And while we'd really like to use a randomized controlled trial, the kind of questions that I just mentioned, it's either not possible or not ethical or both to do randomized trials. Like, we can't randomly assign bad parents to people or longer prison sentences. And so we need to have a way of using observational data to do it. And David Card, Guido Imbens and Josh Angrist really pioneered methods for doing that.
So what they've done is take what's actually happening out there and treating observational data in a way that we can infer causal relationships.
That's exactly right. And the key is your phrase there, treating observational data. We've always had observational data. We've had things like surveys. We've had administrative data about people's tax records, for instance, and their earnings. We've had lots of observational data, you know, going back to the days when it was written down on pen and paper and kept in archives and so on. But if you just look at that kind of data without a method for teasing apart correlation and causation, all you find out is correlation. So an example that is often given is if you just look at the correlation between a woman eating fish during pregnancy and the educational outcome of her offspring, you'll see there's a positive correlation. So you might infer, well, there are lots of nutrients from omega-3s, and you can make an argument for, well, it's really good to eat fish for a fetus in utero because it helps brain development, and then they turn out to do better in school later on and have higher wages, and, you know, we should be subsidizing fish for pregnant women. Perfectly reasonable thing to think. But of course, there's something different about women who tend to eat fish. They tend to be wealthier on average. Sometimes they're more educated. There's all these other confounding factors. And so you can't conclude that if you went and induced women to eat more fish when pregnant, that we'd suddenly have a whole lot of higher achieving kids in our country. And so it's really the causal question which is important for public policy. And so if we spend more money on education, does that help causally, and if so, how much? And basically any policy question is a question of the causal impact of a policy, not on whether it just happens to be associated or correlated with a good or a bad outcome.
All right. Well, let's talk about what these economists did, because looking at the work, one of the things I'm struck by is how relatively recent most of it is, Richard.
Well, that's exactly right. So, you know, a lot of this stuff was done in the early 1990s, and indeed some of it in the late 1990s or 2000s. They did a variety of things. One that's talked about a lot is a paper by David Card, one of the recipients, along with his co-author Alan Kruger, who sadly passed away 2 years ago and otherwise would no doubt have been recognised by the Nobel Committee as well. And that was about minimum wages. So it's a classic debate in economics. If we raise the minimum wage, what's the effect of that? One effect is pretty obvious. It's good for people who are very lowly paid who are getting the minimum wage. But of course, if that means that a whole lot more people are unemployed, then that's a real downside to doing that. And the question is, what does that trade-off exactly look like? And what Card and Kruger did was find a way to figure out the causal impact of an increase in the minimum wage on unemployment. And they looked at fast food restaurants in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and looked at a policy change in one of those states. And by looking at the difference between New Jersey and Pennsylvania and the difference pre and post in both, they were able to show that actually there's very little effect, maybe no effect, on unemployment of raising the minimum wage. And as a result, it really changed the minimum wage debate and said, well, if you go from, at the time it was $4.25 US an hour up to $5.05 an hour, maybe you don't increase unemployment a lot. So maybe that's a good idea. And that's really been important in the policy debate. But its main contribution was to provide a method, a set of tools for doing causal inference about everything from legal institutions to crime and punishment policy to the returns to schooling, the returns to education, and basically any other public policy you can think of.
You mentioned education, something I know that you're very interested in and involved in yourself with your research. I think CARD did some work on education, on school leaving age, where he found those observations that already exist in nature and was able to use them to infer something that we kind of have long suspected, but this makes it clear.
Yes, that's exactly right. He did that in a paper with one of the other laureates, Josh Angrist. And what they did was they looked for a classic natural experiment. In the US, and this is true in some other places as well, there's a minimum leaving age for school. You can't leave school until you're, for example, 16 years old in some jurisdictions. But the day that you start school is the start of the school year. But people are born at roughly randomly different dates. You know, some people are born in February, some people are born in April, some people are born in August and so on. And so the date of your birth is basically like randomly giving you more or less minimum amount of schooling. And so they used that sort of observation, that fact, to say, well, actually, birth is like a natural experiment for how much schooling you get. And so we can look at different birth cohorts and look at their earnings later on in life. And on average, that's telling us something about the returns to education, which is a hugely important thing to understand from a public policy perspective. Should we be investing more in education? Should we be encouraging people to go to school for longer? Should we be subsidising TAFE and tertiary education and things like this? And so they found a way of using a kind of quirk of nature to speak to that really important policy question.
So that is part of the legacy, that natural experiments. You've already mentioned difference in differences, but there are, I suppose, really another few tools and techniques developed that economists like you now have.
That's exactly right. So, you know, they go by different names. As you mentioned, differences in differences. There's the straight-up natural experiment. There are things called regression discontinuity designs where you say, well, maybe there's some cutoff. So people just above or below a certain maybe ATAR get admitted to or not admitted to certain tertiary education programs. Now, the people either side of, say, 90 ATAR, you know, 89.95 or 90.05, they're basically the same in terms of their educational attainment, but they get a discontinuous outcome. Some of them get into the course they want to get into and some of them don't. So what's the impact of that later in life on their earnings and various other things that we care about? So that's another part of the toolkit. There are things called instrumental variables and a range of other things, but they've really informed this very broad range of interesting policy questions.
Your other hat, Richard, is president-elect of the Academy of Social Sciences, and you've already touched on this, but this set of tools, it's not just been taken up by economists.
Well, that's exactly right. So it's become increasingly important across the social sciences. It's true in political science, where these things have been used a lot. You can immediately probably think of a range of political questions about this, how political districts are drawn, the effect of money in politics, some of these big, important questions about how our democracy works and how our politics works that are basically empirical questions. Do disclosure rules on campaign contributions help or hurt? You know, do blockout windows for advertising in the week before the election help or hurt? Or do they even affect electoral outcomes? There's a whole host of questions. It's true in legal scholarship. It's true in criminology. It's true in parts of sociology. So these techniques have been used across the social sciences, which is part of what makes them so influential and also exciting.
Professor Richard Holden from the University of New South Wales. This is The Money with me, Richard Adie. How many Indigenous businesses are there, businesses that are owned by Indigenous Australians? It's a simple question, but we don't know the answer. There are registries, quite a few of them, but no central index. Well, that's changing. Michelle Evans and her team at the University of Melbourne have done some joining together. They've used four of the biggest registries and data from the Bureau of Statistics to come up with a snapshot.
We found 8,133 unique businesses combined on these lists, but when we were able to integrate that data with the Australian Bureau of Statistics, we came up with a sample size of 3,619. So it's still pretty robust of a number. It gives us a really good idea of how many businesses there are, even though it is still partial.
Yeah, it'll almost certainly be a smaller number than what you end up with. What are they worth? How many people do they employ, these businesses?
Yeah, it was quite surprising to us that the gross income across these over 3,500 businesses is $4.88 billion and employing over 45,000 Australians in these firms. We don't have the numbers of how many of them are Indigenous Australians that are employed, but that would be quite a high number, we imagine. So this is an incredibly impactful sector altogether.
So the measure you've come up with, it's called iBlade. What does it capture? What does it tell us?
Well, it tells us a great deal, really, just to kind of get us rolling. It tells us about what industries Indigenous businesses are operating in and where Indigenous businesses are. And we've also tried to start to understand the impact. And all we can really look at the moment is around employment, which is a very impactful kind of statistic to look at. And we're able to kind of think about what contribution these businesses are making where. Like, for instance, the greatest contribution and concentration of businesses in outback Western Australia, so that northern part of WA, the Pilbara region, and you can imagine the great impact that's having, and also in outback Northern Territory. So there's more than 200 businesses operating in 2017-18. So that was the year that we were able to do the capture for.
You said they're in almost every sector, but where in particular are they really showing up?
The six kind of biggest industries that we see is construction services. So that's 17% of these businesses are in that industry. And then that's followed hotly on the heels by 14% in the professional, scientific and technical services industry, which I think is really interesting. I mean, those two different industries need very different firm structures and different talent and different labour to execute their missions. We also have significant businesses in the healthcare and social assistance and the administrative and support services industries. So these are very much white collar industries in a lot of ways, and also critical industries, we think, around the healthcare.
So what you've come up with, I think you've called it iBlade 1.0, it's a tool in a sense that you're planning to kind of build on.
Correct. So as I mentioned before, we have only been able to have four registries integrated into the ABS data now. And so the job for our team, and also working hand in hand with the Indigenous business sector, is to encourage more Indigenous business data custodians to integrate their data into the iBlade. So we're calling on Indigenous chambers of commerce and state governments, and also working with Indigenous Business Australia to integrate their lists and registries of Indigenous businesses so that we can get a greater understanding of what the sector looks like.
All right, Michelle, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks, Richard.
Michelle Evans is head of the Indigenous Business Research Group at the University of Melbourne. Jerry Matira is a Noongar traditional owner from WA. He's the founder of several businesses, including Marawa Business Services, which has just won a national award.
Yeah, so every year Supply Nation, which is a national body that verifies Aboriginal businesses, and it works with suppliers or members who are corporates that want to spend a part of their procurement dollars with Aboriginal businesses. So yesterday we were awarded the Registered Aboriginal Business of the Year, which is pretty exciting.
I'll bet. What does Marawa do?
So Marawa is a building business or construction company. we can build up to $50 million worth of projects. So we can do maintenance and minor works, which is, you know, your more handyman type of work, all the way through to building, you know, apartment complexes or big. Actually, our biggest project to date is a Bunnings store down in Albany in Western Australia. So we completed that in November last year. So we were the first Aboriginal business to build a Bunnings on behalf of Wesfarmers. We're building an apartment complex down in Fremantle, which is the Parry Street Apartments. But all the way through, we're doing lots of commercial construction works.
What sort of turnover, Gerry, and how many employees?
We're heading to around a $20 million turnover. We are 3 years old, so that significant growth has just been out of lots of stimulus, but also corporates wanting to spend money with Aboriginal businesses. We are sitting around 30 employees and 55% Aboriginal participation in that business.
This isn't your first business, and I'll get on to the others in a minute, but why choose a building and building services company?
It was actually about 4 years ago. I was just really having a look at WA's landscape. So what I discovered quite surprisingly was that there were 38,000 apprentices in the whole state. Out of those apprentices, there were 740 Aboriginal apprentices. And in the building trades, there were less than 100. So enter Marawa, which is sort of born out of the idea of creating more Aboriginal employment opportunities for our mob, and try and compete commercially with some of these big boys that have been in the market for a very long time.
So there was just this $5 billion building construction opportunity, and you felt, you know, we could have a piece of that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're looking at what government policies and government announcements, but also looking at how corporates are really wanting to engage. But being an Aboriginal business, the perception really is that we are not going to rock up. We're going to be more expensive because we're going to ask for more money because we've got to do this Aboriginal participation. So in the early stages, it was quite difficult to actually get some runs on the board. And we're always offered low-lying fruit, like the low-risk contracts, you know, the really small maintenance works, which really didn't allow me to employ any Aboriginal people. And over time, we've demonstrated that we will rock up, we'll be competitive, and we'll do the job, if not better, than everybody else will do the job. But also we employ as many Aboriginal people as possible. So, and we team up. You know, our apprentices now, we team them up with Aboriginal tradespeople. So there's a lot of cost training initiatives that happen now. So it's a good initiative, and I think people are kind of seeing that, which is, I think, why one of the reasons we were finalists and then eventually won this award yesterday.
Now, as I mentioned, Gerry, it's not your only business. There's three others. Just briefly walk me through them.
Yeah, look, all the businesses I kind of was set up under the idea of having a look at where Aboriginal people were not succeeding. So, and there are lots of sectors where, and we'll pick the next business that I have is Eon Protection, which is a security business with a national footprint. It was formed out of the idea of I looked at where government was spending their money, who had security contracts, but also just not seeing Aboriginal people represented in or places where you would see security guards, i.e., you know, shopping centres, train lines. And that's where young Aboriginal youth get themselves into trouble. So instead of having the police rock up or taking them away, we wanted to start that community approach and be a precursor to incarceration rates. And today we protect BP Kwinana, which is their refinery plant. We're at KCGM out in Kalgoorlie, which is the gold super pit. A myriad of government agencies across Perth. We look after the Department of Communities, Department of Transport. And, you know, these huge assets are now giving us and trusting us with their assets, and we're proving their misconceptions of what an Aboriginal business is, particularly in the security industry. And I've got a food business called Gather Foods. We are the only Aboriginal food business in Australia, I think, that does what we do. It has many tentacles, but we have a delicatessen on Beaufort Street, which, you know, has charcuterie and cheese. We manufacture all of our products, so our charcuterie products, our jams, chutneys, all sort of influenced by native foods. And we have a factory in Bayswater which produces all of this amazing food. We now have around 18 products in all the IGA stores across Western Australia, and we have one product in Coles supermarkets. And again, the perception of an Aboriginal business probably wouldn't lend itself to be in those stores selling those foods and those products, particularly in Coles.
Indeed. You've also got an energy business, is that right?
Yeah, so Boyer Energy was formed out of the idea also at looking at Aboriginal communities. I took a trip up to the Whitty community, which is a little Aboriginal community just east of Geraldton. And the community there were basically powering their community off diesel generators. And it didn't sit right with me. So Boyer was formed, and Boyer means energy. It was Noongars used a rock, a quartz, and when they struck that quartz, it produced energy. That's where that name came from. So we've teamed up with AGL, one of Australia's largest energy retailers, and we now, in partnership, supply energy to Optus Stadium over here in Perth, Westpac Bank, ATCO, Commonwealth Bank, a whole range of clients. And just in that partnership, you know, AGL has a great initiative around reconciliation, and they have a reconciliation action plan, which sort of dictates how they play in this industry.
Jerry, what does it take to run a sustainable Indigenous business? I'm conscious of the fact that some big corporates know that it's a very good thing to be engaging with Indigenous suppliers, and I imagine government departments too. But what does it take for these businesses to become truly sustainable?
It requires a lot of dedication, and it requires to really get involved in the community. And I mean understanding the issues and risk associated with being an Aboriginal person. And I've had very disheartening conversations with lots of corporates who clearly just don't know how to go about engaging. But I think over time, and it really comes to this word, being resilient to people's perceptions and knowing that we are on a big, long journey, and it is getting easier, and winning these kinds of awards kind of says that we're certainly on the right path. And I think most people's perceptions change over time when you rock up and you are competitive and you do a good job.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
No worries. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Jerry Matera, and you're with The Money on RN and wherever you get your podcasts. Every time you buy something, you're engaging in an act of trust, whether you realise it or not. So the retail sector takes trust extremely seriously and is thinking about it in increasingly sophisticated ways. Michael Roseman's the director of the Centre for Future Enterprise at QUT.
Trust is probably one of the most important leading metrics a retailer can have. And there's strong evidence that trust has three implications. First of all, once I trust my retailer, I'm happy to engage with entire new products. Imagine where a world would look like that you'd say to your retailer, I'm allergic in terms of, let's say, gluten-free or nuts. And at the checkout, the retailer would warn you and say, hey, Richard, don't buy this item. It's a complete new engagement model in which I would only engage with when I trust you. The second one is advocacy. Advocacy means that over a dinner party, I will talk about you. And finally, it's loyalty. People drive back to the old hairdresser in a different suburb because they trust her or him. And it's that sort of contribution to engagement, advocacy and loyalty that makes trust so interesting.
Yeah. Now, you have found that there's actually two types of trust. What are they?
I would say the first one that we found is the commonly known trust, and we call it core trust. So core trust simply means that the retailer delivers on its promise. If I order items online, I expect that they arrive at my doorstep and are in perfect conditions. I might expect that they arrive in the promised delivery time. I might expect that I find a car park or that the checkout doesn't take too long. So core trust simply means you deliver on your promise. The second type of trust is what we call extreme trust. An extreme trust is when I believe the retailer can do a job better than I do. And let me take a complete different industry, music streaming services, as an example.
Okay.
Many of us are using Apple's, Amazon's, or Spotify's to select music for us. And typically, we would argue they do this better than we can. If you go back to a typical retailer, Woolworths, Coles, they would have 20,000 items, of which you might know 1% or 2%. Imagine a world where those retailers would be like Spotify and would literally put the shopping bag together for you, and they would do this better than you could. And that's what we call extreme trust.
Yeah, that makes sense. I probably would I'd have to think about the 200 items I might know from a supermarket. So you need core trust before you get extreme trust. You have to have the core trust first. But that extreme trust, if they've got it, would really add value for the retailer.
Well, I guess if you have extreme trust in a retailer, you probably would go hardly anywhere else. We see this with the way you talk to your doctor. You do typically what your doctor recommends to you. Wine deliveries or some food parcels are a bit like this, where literally the retailer selects the wine for you. So it's those items where there's a lot of choice, where retailers increasingly argue because of the data that they have, they might be able to choose better than you can.
Now, what about fruit and veg, Michael? I know a few people who get home deliveries from supermarkets, but what they don't get is their fruit and veg there.
Correct. Fruit and veggies is one of those items where there's a huge reluctance to buy these items online because these are items that we like to touch, smell, feel. And we don't trust the retailer in many cases to pick these items for you. If the future trusted retailer can address the challenge of picking those items, but also imagine the high-value steak, the scallops or the oysters, you would unlock an entire new set of items, and we call these products trust-intensive products.
Okay. Now, you mentioned trust intensity then, Michael. What is that?
So trust intensity describes the amount of trust I require from you to purchase. If you go to a local convenience store, you put $3 on the table and get a Coke, trust probably doesn't really cross your mind. But if you spend $400 onto opera tickets and see performance where you don't really know what you get, a lot of trust is required. So when you need to trust the process, the people, the product, the overall notion of value for money, and if this increases, then the trust intensity increases.
So I could see how that would matter to retailers. How are they engaging with that?
So this is where retailers need to work out what can they do to either reduce uncertainty or increase confidence. So uncertainty, an example, is how I can further reduce delivery time. You see Amazon's obsession in certain cities to bring delivery time down to hours, if not just 1 hour. That means there's a high level of certainty that I get an item in time when I need it. Confidence, as an example, is when Amazon online has expert reviews. So you don't know if the $400 item that you're about to purchase is of high value. But before you press the purchase button, you can see an expert review. We don't change the product, but we try to boost the confidence we have in this product.
What about organizations that are deliberately reducing the intensity of offerings?
Sometimes it's highly innovative. When you see how a furniture retailer like IKEA has now stores in Vienna without a car park. And the classical business model of IKEA, of course, is that you come and pick and drive away yourselves. But if you don't know if the item that you're about to purchase fits into your car, you're exposed to uncertainty and trust is required. If I deliver, that trust does not matter anymore. And IKEA, with this move of delivery instead of self-driven delivery, massively reduces trust intensity.
I'm conscious as we talk, Michael, that we're kind of moving between the online and the in-store experience. And of course, that is where retail is going. Is retail the sector that's sort of most on top of trying to get its head around and understand trust now?
We, of course, have seen trust problems in industries like banking, finance, aged care. What retail has on offer, of course, is seeing trust as an opportunity. So organizations now increasingly try to compete on trust as opposed to fixing and repairing trust. And that's probably a new dynamic that we haven't seen over the last years across sectors when it comes to the topic of trust.
Michael Roseman from QUT. That's it for this week and this season. We begin a new run next week. It's also the last time I get to say that The Money's producer is Belinda Summer. She's been wonderful. I'm going to miss her. I'm Richard Ady.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.